Okay, so we'll begin with the homage to the Buddha. Three times. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. So today is September 19th, 2015. And today we are taking sutta number 139 in the Middle Length Discourses. In Pali, this is called Arana Vibhanga Sutta. We know the word Vibhanga we've had already with several of the earlier suttas. It means analysis, or here it's rendered exposition. And the word Arana, it's a little bit of a puzzle. The commentary explains the word sarana, not in the sense of refuge, but this is sa plus rana. It explains this word as meaning with dust and with defilement. And so then it explains, you see, sa is a prefix meaning with. And the puzzle here is the word runa. And then it explains the word arana. As meaning without dust, or in other words, without defilement. So it seems to be equating the word runa with dust. But there seems to be another meaning of the word runa, which is not acknowledged by the commentary. And that is battle or conflict. We have some Sri Lankan people here. Anybody named Ranasinghe? Ranasinghe Ranavira? You? Okay, Ranavira. Vira means hero. Now, Ranavira certainly doesn't mean hero of dust or hero of defilements, but it means hero in battle, right? And then there's a common Sri Lankan last name, Ranasinghe. Singha is the same as the Pali Siya, which means lion. And so we don't have a lion of dust, but we have a lion. Somebody who's courageous in battle will be Ranasinghe, the lion of battle. So I think, are there any other Sri Lankan last names with Rana? Ranavira, Ranasinghe. Tunga, I think, means a peak. So Ranatunga would be the peak, at the head of the battle. Is he? Yeah. Well, I said Ranavira. Of Ranaviru. That's just a sort of singleized version of the Ranavira is a more Sanskritized version. Ranaviru is just the singleized version. But it's the same name. Anyway, it seems that the meaning of Rana is conflict. And so Arana will be, as the title is translated here, without conflict, non-conflict. So this seems to be a series of pointers by the Buddha in how to avoid conflict. Okay, so let us look into the sutta itself. Okay, so we start when the Buddha is living at Savati in Jeta's grove, and then he addresses the monks, calls their attention, and then he says, I will teach you, he says, the Arana Vibhanga, that is the analysis of or exposition of non-conflict. And now first in paragraph 3, section 3 here, he's going to lay down what is called the concise teaching, the synopsis or summary, which it's like, as I've explained before, this is the Udesa. Which is almost like a sort of table of contents, a list of the topics that are going to be covered. And then that is followed by the Vibhanga proper, the analysis of those topics. So here we come in paragraph 3 to the Udesa, the list of topics. So he says, one should not pursue sensual pleasures, pleasure which is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, and one should not pursue attakila matanu yoga, the practice of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. And then the way discovered by the Tathagata, that's by the enlightened one, avoids both extremes. It gives vision or insight. It gives knowledge, correct knowledge of the nature of things. It leads to peace, to abhinya, to higher knowledge, to sambodhaya, to awakening or enlightenment, to nibbana. Okay, then, you see, this, the sutta seems to deal with a variety of topics. It almost seems to shift from one topic to another, but all of these topics are in some way, you could say, comprised under the umbrella concept of avoiding conflict, especially teaching the Dhamma without getting into conflict and entanglements with others. Okay, so now it seems to shift almost in a different direction. One should know what it is to extol and what it is to disparage. And knowing both, one should neither extol nor disparage, but should teach only the Dhamma. And this has a somewhat different meaning than different implications than might be immediately apparent. Okay, one should know how to define pleasure or happiness, and knowing that, one should pursue pleasure or happiness within oneself. Then one should not utter covert or hidden speech, and one should not utter overt, sharp speech. One should speak hurriedly, not hurriedly. One should not insist on local language, and one should not override or go beyond or bypass normal usage. This is the summary of the exposition of non-conflict. Okay, so he says this is the summary, this is the Udesa, the list of topics that I'm going to treat. And as we go on, what seems to emerge from this is that a lot of the topics are concerned, I would say, not so much with what I would call the Dhamma itself, but how to expound the Dhamma, how to give a proper presentation of the Dhamma. Okay, so now we'll go into with the next paragraph, we start the actual Vibhanga, the analysis or exposition. Okay, so he says, okay, first he mentions the sort of topic or the item from the table of contents. One should not pursue sensual pleasure, which is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial. And one should not pursue self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. Does anybody recognize this expression from another context? Exactly, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, from the Buddha's first discourse, when he first started to teach the Dhamma. In fact, when he first addressed the five ascetics, he said that one who has gone forth into the homeless life should not pursue or follow two extremes. Then he mentions the two extremes. One is the extreme of sensual indulgence, the other is the extreme of self-mortification. And what has to be pointed out, I don't think this is done often enough, is that when the Buddha uses this expression, he's teaching ascetics or monastics. That's why he says one should not pursue sensual pleasure. It doesn't mean that the Buddha is telling all of his disciples, those who are householders, lay people, give up sensual pleasures altogether. Because, I mean, it's natural for people living the household life to indulge in such sensual pleasures to some extent. But what he's doing is setting up a kind of ideal. First, he's teaching ascetics or renunciants who have deliberately renounced sensual pleasures not to revert to indulgence in sensual pleasures. Because if they indulge in sensual pleasures, then they're violating the very reason or intention in their going forth, which is to lead a life of renunciation. But when the Buddha is speaking to lay people, it's convenient in having the class in the library is that I could get the book that I want. Ravi, can I see it? Or Sandy? There's a gray book. It's called The Numerical Discourses of the Buddha. You see, Okaidi is close to it. Does it have a wrapper, the plastic wrapper? Numerical Discourses of the Buddha. It has the plastic wrapper. Oh, we don't want to break the wrapper. Anyway, I know the passage from... Okay. Okay. Yeah, there's a long sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya. It's a book of tens, number 91, in which the Buddha speaks of what he calls 10 kinds of persons in the world who enjoy sensual pleasures. And then he goes through different permutations of these types to arrive finally at the one who is the best or the ideal of those who enjoy sensual pleasures. And so of this, he says that the one enjoying sensual pleasures who seeks wealth righteously without violence, that is, who earns his living by right livelihood, not hurting others in pursuit of his livelihood, and makes himself happy and pleased, and shares it, and does meritorious deeds. So one uses a certain portion of the wealth to secure the well-being of oneself and one's family. Then one shares the wealth with others through the practice of generosity and does other meritorious deeds. And then, he says, and uses that wealth without being tied to it, infatuated with it, and blindly bogged down in it, seeing the danger or disadvantage in it, and understanding the escape or the release from the attachment to it. That person may be praised on four grounds: that he seeks wealth righteously, he makes himself happy and pleased, he shares the wealth and does meritorious deeds, and then he uses the wealth without being tied to it. And then he says, of all of those who enjoy sensual pleasures, this is the best, the preeminent, the supreme, the one that I just described. So we could say that, you know, that there's a contrast between what the Buddha will expect from lay people who are earning a living and living in the world, and from those who have renounced the world. And so this teaching about not pursuing sensual pleasures, it's directly intended for those who have renounced the world, but it also sets up an ideal for those who are still, you know, earning wealth and still enjoying sensual pleasures, but to strive in the direction of the relinquishment of sensual pleasures. Okay, now the Buddha then raises the question with reference to what was this said. And then comes a phrase or an expression that's rather complicated in the Pali. Let's try it to untangle it. The pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desire, then we just skip over the adjectives, that is a state by suffering, a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever. It is the wrong way or the wrong practice. So we can say that the pursuit, to simplify it, we could say that the pursuit of sensual pleasures is a state beset by suffering and so on, and the wrong way. Then disengagement from the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desires, or more simply, disengagement from the pursuit of sensual pleasures. This is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever. Fever means the fever of passion. It is the right way. Then the pursuit of self-mortification. This was the mode of practice taken up in the Buddha's time, even still continues in India, of those ascetics who think that the way to purification, the way to liberation, is through the torment of the body, by undertaking these extreme ascetic practices, like sleeping on beds of nails or beds of thorns, going on long fasts, standing on one leg for days on end, immersing oneself in the water and staying in the water for, you know, for hours and hours, or exposing the body. There's a practice, it's called, I think, the five fires. You light fires in each of the major directions on the hottest days of the year around one, the fire to the north, east, south, and west. Then the fifth fire is the overhead sun, and then one stands there enduring the pain of the heat. And that's considered, you know, a noble purifying practice. Okay, but the Buddha says that this is just a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it's the wrong way. And then disengagement or detachment or relinquishing that pursuit of self-mortification, that's the state without suffering, and that is the right way. Okay, so now the Buddha is setting up like these two extremes, and then he says that the middle way discovered by the Tathagata avoids both these extremes. So the sort of the function of the middle way, the reason why the middle way becomes the way to liberation for the Buddha is because it's the way that gives rise to vision or insight, direct insight into the nature of things. It gives knowledge, comprehension of the nature of things. It leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. And then what is that noble eightfold, what is that middle way? It's just the noble eightfold path. So again, this is, you know, referring back to the Buddha's first discourse, to the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta. So all of this should be fairly familiar to those who know, who are already acquainted with the first discourse. But here, if we take this in context of the rest of the sutta, it seems that the Buddha's purpose in bringing this here is not to teach the monks anything new as far as their actual knowledge goes, but to show them, well, this is my interpretation, the right way to teach the Dhamma. When you're teaching, don't encourage people to indulge in sensual pleasures. Don't encourage people to undertake self-mortification, but teach them to follow the middle way, which is the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, now we'll come to the next section. Okay, so he says, one should know what it is to extol and what it is to disparage. The Pali words here are usadana and upasadana. Usadana is like extolling, lifting up, pushing up. And upasadana is almost corresponds exactly to the English expression, colloquial expression, to put down, to put somebody down. And so then the Buddha says, knowing both, one should not extol nor disparage, but should teach only the Dhamma. And with reference to what was this said, okay, from what comes next, we could now see the connection to the previous passage on the two extremes and the middle way. So it says, how does there come to be the extolling and disparaging and failure to teach only the Dhamma? So he says, when one says, all those engaged in the pursuit, let's simplify it, all those engaged in the pursuit of sensual pleasures are beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the wrong way, one thus disparages some. When one says all those who are detached from the pursuit of sensual pleasures, are without suffering, and so on, and they have entered upon the right way, one thus extols some. Now notice that the key idea here is that one is extolling some people and disparaging other people. And so the point in the Buddha's method of teaching is not to extol individuals as such because of the particular path that they've taken, but rather, well, actually, okay, the same thing is then pursued, developed with regard to those who follow self-mortification. Okay, when one says all those engaged in self-mortification are beset by suffering and that they have entered on the wrong way, one is disparaging some. When one says all those disengaged from the pursuit of self-mortification are without suffering and they have entered on the right way, one thus extols some. Again, when one teaches in that way, then one is phrasing one's teaching by way of praising and disparaging individuals or people. Okay, I just want to skip over what comes next because it just is along the same line and get to paragraph 8. Okay, so how does there come to be neither extolling nor disparaging, but teaching only the Dhamma? Okay, when one does not say all those engaged in the pursuit of sensual pleasures have entered upon the wrong way, but says instead the pursuit is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way, then one teaches only the Dhamma. And similarly, when one does not say all those who are detached from the pursuit of sensual pleasures have entered upon the right way, but says instead the disengagement is a state without suffering, and so on, and it is the right way, then one teaches only the Dhamma. Okay, now here when you see teaching the Dhamma, you think that means teaching the Buddha's teaching the Buddha's doctrine. But the word Dhamma has a number of meanings. And here, what I see to be underlying this is one meaning of Dhamma as the principle. So there's a difference between teaching in terms of persons, which is when you're praising some, disparaging others, and teaching in terms of the principle, or you could say the rationale. So here the principle is that the principle is that the pursuit of sensual pleasures is beset by suffering and the wrong way. So when one teaches in that way, then one is teaching simply the principle without praising and saying, ah, these people are detached from sensual pleasures. They are so wonderful, so pure, so saintly, so holy. Those people just indulge in sensual pleasures. They're so wretched, so vile, so low in character. But instead, one is avoiding praising and disparaging, and instead just elucidating the principle. Okay, and then the same basic principle, you could say, basic way of understanding it can apply to each of the following paragraphs. I don't have to elaborate upon them. But you see, in each case, one is avoiding praising and extolling some, those who are engaged in what we would take to be the right practice. One avoids disparaging those who are engaged in what we take to be the wrong practice. Instead, one is saying, this is the wrong practice, this is the right practice, avoid the wrong practice, follow the right practice. So what's called teaching the Dhamma means explaining the principles, the guidelines, without using one's teaching as a way to, say, play particular individuals off against one another. Does this seem clear at this point? Any questions at this point before we go further? So should we move on? Okay, so now next the Buddha brings up a somewhat different topic. Maybe this is I would see this as continuing along the line of avoiding the two extremes and following the middle way. So he says one should know how to define pleasure or happiness. The Pali word is sukha, which has both meanings. And knowing that, one should pursue pleasure or happiness ajatang, which means within oneself, an internal happiness. Okay, so why was this said? Then the Buddha speaks about the five kinds or objects of sensual pleasure. These are form, sounds, odors, tastes, tactile objects, which are agreeable, likable, desirable, provocative of desire or lust. So those are the five objects of sensual pleasure. And then the pleasure and joy, sukha somanasa, that arise dependent on these five objects of sensual pleasure are called sensual pleasure. So the kind of sensual pleasure that's to be avoided is the pleasure and joy that arise dependent on delightful objects of the five senses. And then the Buddha says that this kind of pleasure, sensual pleasure, he calls it a filthy pleasure. And here the word filthy, in English, it tends to have moralistic implications. Whereas in Pali, milha, it just suggests something like the dirt on the ground. And it's a coarse pleasure, an ignoble pleasure. I say of this kind of pleasure that it should not be pursued, developed, cultivated, but that it should be feared. Again, this is especially the case for those who are entered upon the homeless life. Of course, it's attraction to the sensual pleasures that lead one to give up the homeless life and then sometimes to commit evil, even unwholesome deeds, which will lead to the bad realms of rebirth. And then in contrast, the Buddha is now speaking about a higher kind of pleasure. This is the pleasure or happiness to be found ajatang, within oneself or internally. So this is the pleasure of the four jhanas. And then the Buddha calls this the bliss of renunciation, nekama sukha. The bliss of seclusion or solitude, paviveka sukha. The bliss of peace, upasama sukha. And even sambodha sukha, the bliss of enlightenment. Which doesn't mean that attaining the jhanas themselves is equivalent to enlightenment. But the jhanas are part of the Noble Eightfold Path, leading to Nibbana, and the bliss of the jhanas are said to give a foretaste of the bliss of Nibbana. Then the Buddha then says, of this kind of happiness, that it should be pursued, should be developed, should be cultivated, and should not be feared. Okay, so it was reference to this, that it was said one should know how to define, well, let's say to distinguish different types of pleasure and happiness, and then one should pursue pleasure within oneself. And pleasure within oneself, we see, means the bliss of the jhanas. And this, even if one doesn't achieve the bliss of the jhanas, I mean, that's a very rare achievement, but even what strikes me about the practice of meditation is that, you know, people, they think in order to be happiness, you have to get this, you have to acquire that, you need, well, it's all right to have a nice house, but some people think they need four or five homes, very impressive cars. And constantly, you know, the whole commercial culture continually provokes in us the idea that you're not happy unless you possess increasing amounts of material possessions, which are distinguished by their glitter, their novelty, by their ability to help you surpass, outdo your neighbors. And so all of this is a kind of outward pursuit of happiness, which is constantly being undermined by the fact that one is never satisfied with what one gets. But even if you're sitting in meditation with a wandering mind, but after some time, once the mind starts to settle down, you can see that you have all of the requisites of happiness are just within oneself. And then if one continues to pursue this practice, over time, you know, the different accumulations of distraction and disturbance start to bubble off, and then springs of inner happiness come welling up from deep within, and then one feels a contentment with simply with having this mind and body, even this very flawed mind and body. You know, so ascetics who are living in, you know, forest hermitages, ascetic monks, I mean, well, you can't see them so easily, but, you know, often the only thing they own are their robes, their alms bowl, maybe a few little medicines, toothbrush, toothpaste, a little kuti or hut, and they're perfectly happy. Whereas you have your well, Buddha says you shouldn't refer to people, but your Koch brothers and your Donald Trump. I only have 4 billion, that guy has 6 billion. It doesn't look good on my resume that I'm $2 billion behind him in income. Okay, the next section. Here one should not utter what's called covert speech, rahu vadam. Rahu would be like speaking perhaps privately about somebody, critically about somebody in private. Let's see if we can unpack it by looking at it. Okay, and one should not utter overt sharp speech. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said. Here, when one knows covert speech, private or hidden speech, to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, one should on no account utter it. Okay, this speech has to be knocked down on two accounts. It's untrue. Incorrect is just a synonym. So it's untrue, and it's without any benefit. So on both grounds, one doesn't utter it. Okay, when one knows covert speech to be true and correct, but unbeneficial, then the Buddha says one should try not to utter it. Or actually the Pali text says one should train oneself not to utter it. But when one knows covert speech to be true, correct, and beneficial, one may utter it knowing the time to do so. I'm trying to think of instances where this works. Maybe some of you can help me out. Speaking privately. Oh, I think this would... Actually, if one takes this to be speaking privately to another person, actually, this makes sense. When I was reading it last night, I was thinking, interpreting it to mean talking about another person, but not in their presence. But if we take it to mean speaking privately to another person about what is, you know, saying, I want to speak to you, please come into my office, then it makes sense, or at least I could think of, you know, numerous cases where it works. So when it's correct what one is going to bring up, to criticize another person for, or to discuss with that person, and it's beneficial, then it makes sense to speak, notice, knowing the time to do so. You know, so if your son is playing baseball with his friends and you found out that, you know, he didn't do his homework or he didn't do the house duties, you don't call him away from his baseball game and start criticizing him. You have to find the right opportunity, know the right time. And also this works within monastic life, that when one monk is to criticize another privately, he'll call that monk when it's inopportune time. Not if the monk is sort of sitting in meditation, you come to his room and then you sort of shake him out and say, come, you didn't do the dishes. Yeah. You left your dishes on the table and just got up and walked away without washing them. But you wait till, you know, he's maybe just taking a walk or doing... He just shows that he's not engaged with anything else. Other occasions when it's useful to speak not directly to a person, but this would be covert speech, true, correct, and beneficial, one is speaking to somebody else about another person at the right time. Are there such situations? That's a good example. Yeah. So you want to get some advice from another about how do you deal with this person. I think this applies more to the next section that we're going to come to. Any other ideas? Anyway, it's something to think about.
Test.
Okay, let us come to the next section. Okay, when one knows, now the Buddha is speaking about or with reference to what's called overt, sharp speech. And this is sammukha. Sammukha means in the presence. But if covert speech can include speaking directly to somebody, say, about their faults, their omissions, and so on, then overt sharp speech might mean criticizing somebody in a group, perhaps. I have to say, the commentary just provides word glosses. It doesn't exemplify what is meant by these expressions, so it's hard to know exactly what's intended. Okay, so when one knows overt, sharp speech to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, of course, then one should not utter it. When one knows overt, sharp speech to be true, correct, and unbeneficial, then one should train oneself not to utter it. But when one knows overt, sharp speech to be true, correct, and beneficial, one may utter it knowing the time to do so. Yeah, so if we take covert speech to be speaking privately to a person about to criticize them in private, then overt, sharp speech would be speaking openly in a group to somebody. Maybe somebody who's been a real persistent troublemaker refuses to take advice from others, and, you know, when given to them privately, and is disturbing the whole group because of his behavior. And in that case, it becomes necessary to call that person into the presence of the group, even to speak to them. Initially, perhaps one should start speaking politely, but sometimes we have people who are always out to defend themselves and then to try to turn the tables on their accusers and accuse the other person of faults, till sometimes one has to speak to them sharply. And even, I mean, we've had experience like this in our monastic group in Sri Lanka to expel them from the monastery. I remember we had one monk in our group in Sri Lanka who started to make trouble during the time was there when I was there. I had gone to Singapore. This was in 2001, 2002, while he and his disciple were still at the monastery, and they continued to make trouble for all of the other monks. So all of the other monks had to sort of meet together, and they decided, I think with the advice of the Mahanayaka, that's the chief monk of this division of the Sangha, to ask him to leave. And so they asked him to leave. Then I had an experience that summer. I went from Singapore to Germany. Now this monk is of European origins, and so I was invited to go to the Vaisak celebration. This was in May at the Hamburg Buddhist Society. And so there was a woman named Monica who drove me to the center of the to the headquarters of the Buddhist Society. And then we got out of the car and she said, "Oh, there's another monk inside." Then I looked through the window and I saw the back. I saw the yellow color, the particular shade of orange, of exactly the kind of robe this other monk in Sri Lanka always would wear. And that monk was always a little bit unshaven. And the person that I saw inside was somewhat unshaven. So the thought came into my mind, "Well, we don't believe in God," but I said, "Oh my God, he's there." How did I get into this quagmire? Sure, since he's European, he probably came back to Europe for summer, and they somebody invited him to come to this Pesach celebration, and now I somehow got into this difficulty, and now I'm sure when we go inside, even though I wasn't in the Sangha at that time, I wasn't in the monastery, but he knew that I was a member of that group, so I'm imagining as soon as I step in the door, he's going to confront me. And what am I going to say to him? I'll say, but I wasn't there. But he'll say, I knew you were the I knew you were the plotter. You were behind the plot. So all these thoughts are bubbling through my mind. I'm thinking, maybe I should say to Monica, well, let's skip it. Tell him that I'm sick. But then I thought, you have to be courageous, have to be patient, just contain yourself, get hold of yourself. We come into the room, and I don't see another monk, but I see one of the men at the celebration is wearing a kind of copper orange t-shirt, and he has short cropped hair, and, you know, a little bit unshaven. But there was a Buddhist nun also in the room. So Monica either saw the man who was sitting against the window with the copper shirt and short cropped hair and thought he was a monk, or she was referring to the nun as another monk. But my mind was building up this whole drama, which just suddenly came crashing to the ground. You know, I was looking around, where is he? Where is he? Okay, that's a diversion. You know, in the Shakespearean dramas, they have usually a little scene someplace in the drama. They call it the comic relief. Okay, so when one knows overt chop speech is correct and beneficial, then one may utter it, again, knowing the proper time to do so. Okay, the next section, one should speak unhurriedly, not hurriedly. And then what is the reason for this? And this is just almost like common sense, that when one speaks hurriedly, one's body gets tired, one's mind gets excited, one's voice is strained, one's throat becomes hoarse, and the speech of one who speaks hurriedly is indistinct and hard to understand. But when one speaks unhurriedly, one's body doesn't grow tired, one's mind doesn't become excited, and so on, and one's speech is distinct and easy to understand. So all of this is just common sense. Okay, then comes the next passage. One should not insist on local language, and one should not override normal usage. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said. And the word translated, or the expression translated, local language is Janapada Niruti. Janapada usually means a country or a region, and Niruti is the language or expression. And one should not override normal usage. This is samanyang. This is the common designations, the normal way of expression. Okay, for what reason is this said? Okay, first the Buddha explains how there is insistence on local language and overriding of normal usage. And now in India, in the Buddha's time, there are many different regions and districts. most of them in the area where the Buddha traveled used a variation on Magadhi. Magadhi would have been the language of the state of Magadha, what corresponds now to Bihar. And so this language would have been a derivative from, originally derived from Vedic Sanskrit, but infiltrated or absorbed many colloquial type expressions. There would be different changes in phonology or sound values. But the Buddha traveled into many regions, going from probably the furthest to the west would be where Delhi is now, New Delhi, and going to the east into what is now West Bengal. And so there would be different, especially for objects of ordinary usage, they would have different terms. Whereas the more philosophical terms would have been very similar from region to region. So he's saying in different localities they call the same thing. We have in one region pati, another region patta, another region vita, another region sairava, another region darupa, another region pona, another region pisila. Nyanamoli just came up with a variety of English words, but it's intended to refer to the same thing, which is a dish. And so the Buddha says, whatever they call it in such locality, one speaks accordingly, firmly adhering to the expression, insisting only this is correct. Anything else is wrong. That is how there comes to be insistence on local language and overriding normal usage. It's a little difficult to see how this would apply today. I don't know, you have idea of some examples?
A cloth. Am I supposed to hold this thing?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. What do I do? Just like this? Okay. One person corrected me on how to fold a cloth.
Yeah.
Another, and he also corrected me on how to place a sutra book on a table, and two or three other things. Now he's really a very nice guy, and he's trying to be helpful.
Yeah.
But my interpretation is that he was doing something that I think Sam might have been alluding to, and that's looking at the cultural cultural values of Chinese culture and Chinese Buddhism specifically, and looking at it in a kind of generalizing it as though it were the rule. And I think that might be analogous to the language aspect, because when we insist on using a particular word as though it had ultimate reality or ultimate truth, as opposed to another word, which is really just as good in a relative sense, and it's a relative issue anyway, that might be... I know I'm being very wordy. But I'm trying to make an analogy and say... Language is a reflection of culture.
Yeah.
And so when I say, no, my culture is right and your culture is wrong, I think it sounds to me as though that's very much the issue here.
Yeah, actually, that's a good analogy, actually. And it also makes me think of a few things. I'm not relating it to, I'm finding it a little difficult to relate to language, but to customs. Like, okay, the last few days I was at the Sri Lankan temple in Queens. So when they serve the food, you know, they offer me, do you want the spoon? But none of them are using spoons. They're all using their hands to eat from the food. Now here, if I were to start using my hands to eat, everybody would look like I was crude and cultured because it's not, you know, part of the traditional Chinese culture to eat with the hands. So instead here, well, usually I use spoon, but you could use chopsticks. Whereas in Sri Lankan temple, if you ask for, can I have chopsticks, I doubt that they have them there. Yeah. Yeah. But notice now we have to take the second part of the Buddha statement. Okay, he says, whatever they call it in such and such a locality, one speaks accordingly. Wait. Okay, let's just take the part that begins. And how does there come to be non-insistence on local language and non-overriding of normal usage? So here in different localities, they call the same thing, you know, a dish, a bowl, a vessel. So whatever they call it in such and such a locality, without adhering to that expression, one speaks accordingly, thinking these venerable ones are speaking with reference to this. So that is how there comes to be non-insistence on local language and non-overriding of normal usage. A little dense, the way of expression. What I would take it to mean is that one adapts oneself to the way things are expressed in a particular region, or we could say more broadly, one adapts to the customs of the particular group in which one is living without insisting that this is the only way. Now, so if one is in the big Buddha hall in a Chinese monastery and a monk says, like, this is the correct way to close the sutra and put it on the stand, then one follows that, thinking, you know, this isn't the absolute truth, but this is the convention, and under these circumstances, one conforms to the convention. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Well, you see, the word here is, it comes up maybe more clearly, abhinivesaya, which has the idea of being attached to it. Of course, flexibility is what's called for, but I think this is not insisting, not adhering to, maybe it's the language of the particular region. One doesn't, I don't know, I have to say it's a bit obscure to me. Yeah, that seems to be the sense. Yeah. 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 Yeah, I think that's a sense, yeah. Did you have some comment back there? Wait, I'm not getting the sound so clearly. Oh, I see. I'm not sure that's the implication here. I mean, that's a matter of sort of policy considerations, whereas this is advice for a monk who's gone out to teach the Dhamma. So it seems the point is to be, I would say, flexible as regarding terminology, and not to insist that the particular terminology that one knows oneself, that one is familiar with, has some kind of absolute value to it. And one could say this passage, though it's not brought out explicitly, but it may be sort of implicitly undercutting the Brahminic belief that the language of the Vedas, which they call Sanskrit, was in some way a sacred language, the eternal language, the language which was the language of divine creation. You know, this was the Brahminic belief, and it could be that, though the passage, as I said, isn't stating that explicitly, but it's undercutting the absolute value of any language, the absolute validity of any language, even though the Pali tradition has adopted pretty much the same attitude with regard to the Pali language, so that they say in the Pali commentaries that if you take an infant who's just been born somehow and you put him out in the woods so that he grows up without any exposure to human beings, and then at the age of maturity, 14 or 15, he comes into human contact and has to express himself, then he'll be speaking the Mula Bhasa, the root language, or the Sabhava Bhasa, the natural language, which is Pali. So if anybody wants to learn Pali well, just go off into seclusion. Don't expose yourself to any English books and newspapers and so on. Naturally, as the familiarity with English wears off, you'll be speaking Pali. Yes? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Wait, it's good if you have the mobile microphone.
Okay. This is much better. So, Bhante, I totally agree with you. It must be in that, reference where at the time of Buddha, it was Sanskrit that was predominant and was spoken by the Brahmins. Mm. And then when he wanted to take Dhamma to each and everybody and to common man, and common man's language was Pali at the time. And maybe,
There would have been a variety of languages, dialects over Northeast India. Yeah.
Yeah, but definitely Sanskrit was one which was kept secret with one section of the community. And even what I was referencing was today also, you know, when we say that languages, there are many languages, like thousands of languages in India. And there's a liberty that, you know, one person whosoever wants to learn one language should have the liberty and, you know, flexibility to learn whatever one wants.
Yeah.
But we've seen recently that some views who are just against, you know, Buddhism or whatever, they will say, okay, in this exam, Pali is out. You know?
Ooh,
yeah.
Really?
In civil services exam, they have taken out Pali.
Wow. Entirely. Wow.
So, you know, and they're trying to do Sanskrit, everything in Sanskrit. I mean, definitely teach Sanskrit, but don't take
and
something.
What?
I mean, if somebody wants to teach Sanskrit, it should be fine, but don't take something out from curriculum. So maybe, you know, with regards to that, it came out that it should not be like one preference should be given to just one language, which is understood by just one section of the community and not everyone and all.
Okay. I just want to bring up like what would be an example of overriding common usage that doesn't refer to different languages, but this is some people think that, okay, in following Buddhism, I shouldn't use the word I or myself, because if I do that, then I'm sort of underlying that usage as a subtle attachment to the idea of the ego or the self. And so they'll say, well, this collection of five aggregates has to go to the bathroom.
When the Buddha was saying, don't speak in, you know, harsh words or extol in private, is that what, do you think that might have been what he was referring to?
No, I think that's just referring to ordinary speech, not to a particular language.
But then Sanskrit was only spoken amongst the Brahmin class. It wasn't the common language.
First, I don't think that Sanskrit is a literary language. It wasn't a spoken language. Maybe during the Vedic period, which was like 1,500 years before the Buddha. 1,500 to 100 to 1,000 years before the Buddha. Maybe it was a spoken language. But by the time of the Buddha, probably everybody in Northeast India was speaking some dialect of based on Magadhi. In Western India, there would be pretty much all of those languages belong to the same family. They're descended from Vedic Sanskrit, but they pick up they undergo phonological changes to make it easier to enunciate. The grammar becomes somewhat simplified, as we say. See, if we compare Pali and Sanskrit. Sanskrit pretty much was the language. I don't know that it was ever a spoken language. It was a literary language. Brahmins can use it to speak to each other. And then I think the great classical poets and dramatists use Sanskrit for their poetry and the drama. What's the name of the famous Sanskrit dramatist? Kalidasa, is that it? Yeah, he wrote his dramas in Sanskrit. But the spoken language, I don't think so.
Of the Prakriti and also of Sanskrit, and also of Sanskrit, because if Sanskrit were not a spoken language by the people, then the other languages could not derive from it.
No, that's not the case. That the other languages derive from Vedic Sanskrit, which would have been the language used in the Vedas, which it's an older form of Sanskrit. Whether it was ever a spoken language, that I don't know. It might have been. But So this, all of this is so... I'm not a philologist, and I haven't studied the origin of the Indian languages. I just know the... They call them the classification of the three main periods of the Indian languages, the old Indo-Aryan languages, which is taken to be Vedic Sanskrit, middle Indo-Aryan languages, which includes Pali, variety of Prakrits, then classical Sanskrit actually comes later, formulated by Panini and Patanjali in the Sanskrit grammars, and then comes modern Indo-Aryan languages, which include Hindi, Marathi, Bengali, maybe Hindustani. So they're all sort of within a stream of evolution, which goes back even to, you know, earlier language, which then those who spoke it spread out over parts of Asia and even Europe, so that there are affinities between Greek and Sanskrit, English and Sanskrit, so that they're distant, very distant cousins. Okay, I just want to wrap up the sutta. Okay, in the final section, the Buddha just sort of lines up all of the different dichotomies that he's established in the sutta, stating that one is on the side of, or a state with conflict. It's an arana dhamma. So the pursuit of sensual pleasures is a state with conflict. Disengagement from the pursuit of sensual pleasures is a state without conflict. The pursuit of self-mortification is a state with conflict. Disengagement from self-mortification is a state without conflict. The middle way is a state without conflict. Extolling and disparaging is a state with conflict. Not extolling and not disparaging, but teaching just the Dhamma or the principle is a state without conflict. Sensual pleasures is a state with conflict. The bliss of renunciation and so forth is a state without conflict. Covert speech that is untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, and covert speech that is true, correct, and unbeneficial, both are states with conflict. Covert speech that is true, correct, and beneficial is a state without conflict. Overt, sharp speech that is untrue, overt sharp speech that is true and unbeneficial, both are states with conflict. Overt sharp speech that is true, correct, and beneficial is a state without conflict. Speaking hurriedly is a state with conflict. Well, I'm speaking hurriedly now. Speaking unhurriedly is a state without conflict. Insisting on local language and overriding normal usage is a state with conflict. Not insisting on local language and not overriding normal usage is a state without conflict. Okay, then the Buddha says, you should train yourselves thus. We will know the state with conflict, and we will know the state without conflict. And knowing these, we will enter upon the way without conflict. Then the Buddha praises the monk named Subhuti, saying Subhuti is a clansman, Kulaputta, a young man, who has entered upon the way without conflict. And who is this Subhuti? According to the commentary, he said to have been the younger brother of Anathapindika. Anathapindika was the Buddha's chief donor, lay supporter. And Subhuti doesn't play a very prominent role in the Pali Suttas. There are just very few places that mention him. But yet, when the Buddha established categories of great disciples in different areas, and he appointed Subhuti to be the great disciple a foremost disciple in two areas. One area is that of those who dwell arana, without conflict. The other area is the foremost of those who are worthy of offerings. On what basis, you know, why he appoints Subhuti to those titles? It's a bit puzzling to me. Like, why does he pass over Sariputta, Mahakasapa, some of the other great disciples, and appoints Subhuti, who's very obscure in the Pali canon, to those positions? I don't know. What's interesting is that Subhuti, though he's mentioned only in a few places in the Pali canon, but then in the Mahayana Prajnaparamita sutras, he becomes the primary, call this, conversationalist or interlocutor with the Buddha on the perfection of wisdom. So we see this in the Diamond Sutra, 8,000-line all of the Prajnaparamita sutras. So it's mainly Subhuti speaking together with the Buddha, sometimes with Sariputta or some others. And if you want to see Subhuti in person, well, you don't see him in person, but if you go along the what's called the Bodhi path here at the monastery, he is at the top of the path facing the great Buddha hall on the left. So you see the image of Subhuti. And you see he is sitting with, it looks like a palm leaf manuscript on his lap. Probably that is because he is the foremost exponent of the Prajnaparamita. So that might be the collection of Prajnaparamita sutras on his lap. Okay, if there are any, just a few questions, and then we could have come together after the lunch for more discussion. Any quick questions, please? Excuse me?
Thanks. At the top of page 84 in paragraph 10, it says, but when one knows covert speech to be untrue, true be true, correct and beneficial, one may utter it, knowing the time to do so. Does it point? It doesn't really explain how one knows what the time to do so is.
Yeah.
In this sutta, but I was wondering if there's any other references or anything else that could point to this, because it's interesting, because then it sort of points to there being in a precise time to actually do something, and then the question then becomes, how does one know when to do that?
Yes, an interesting question. I'm just trying to think whether there are any other suttas. I know there are numbers of suttas which speak about, in fact, it's said to be like one of the important qualities in a teacher is knowing the right time. Like in the numerical discourses, the Anguttara Nikaya. Ooh. Okay. It wasn't open. I was afraid it was open. Yeah, the sutta is Anguttara Nikaya, Book of Fives, number 167. It speaks about the proper way to reprove or to criticize others. And so the first of these is that one should consider, I will speak at a proper time, not at an improper time. Anyone could look at that sutta. It's a little difficult. I'd have to sort of read it quickly here and then sort of digest it and see whether it develops the theme of time. But maybe it's just an intuitive matter that one knows that in a situation where you don't interrupt somebody who's engaged in an activity, or you don't embarrass that person in front of a group, when the person is still amenable to correction. Okay, maybe we should go up and take the midday meal now and then come back, let's say 12:15. So we'll end. And Sandy just reminded me that, you know, our organization, Buddhist Global Relief, will be having the walk to feed the hungry. This is to take place on Saturday, October 31st. So every year we have this walk whereby we try to raise funds for the projects of Buddhist Global Relief, which provide... The mission of Buddhist Global Relief is to combat chronic hunger and malnutrition either through, in a variety of ways, through direct food relief, by sponsoring projects that promote ecologically sustainable agriculture, by promoting the education of poor girls in disadvantaged communities, and by enabling women to start right livelihood projects to support their families. So this is an information brochure about the walk, and I will be present at this walk. In fact, I will be doing 5 walks this fall from Michigan next Sunday. And Seattle, Washington, San Francisco, California, New York City, October 31st and November 8th in Wilmington, Connecticut. If anybody also lives in Connecticut, they could join the Connecticut Walk. And that reminds me, before we break, next week after the class, I'll need a ride to the airport. I think it's the LaGuardia Airport. Would anybody going in that direction? I still want to do the class. How many people are going on the retreat? So there'll be 3, but I want to do the class because otherwise I'll be missing several classes in October, and then there'll be too few classes. I think it's about 5:00. But if you'll be on the retreat, then I don't want you to leave. You know, if somebody else is going in that direction. But I can go to the airport early. It doesn't matter. Well, you just settle. Johnny raised his hand. Are you going in that direction? If anybody is going towards Queens, then it's the easiest way. You'll be on the retreat. No, I don't want you to interrupt the retreat. Okay. Okay, so we have a volunteer. Okay. I'll just recite the sharing of the merits. Okay, so we do the sharing of the merits. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahedika punyanta nanumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahedika punyanta nanumoditva Chirang rakantu desanang akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabhe devanumodantu sabasampati siddhya sabhe bhutanumodantu Sabha sampati siddhya, sabhe satanumodantu, sabha sampati siddhya, bhavagupadaya vichihetato, etantare satakayupapanna, rupiya rupicha sanya sanino, dukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Okay, so we end with three half bows to the Buddha.